Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and welcome back. You're back, right? Not your first time? Good. This week's episode is one I've been sitting on for a while. It's the other show I recorded during August's New York trip. The location is a production company on the Bowery, so the sound's a little on the granular side, but the guest more than makes up for it. It's Alex Ross Perry, writer-director of Listen Up, Philip, and Queen of Earth, which will make its Canadian premiere this Tuesday, October 13th, in Toronto, at the Royal. Details at the end of the episode. Alex picked Somewhere, Sofia Coppola's 2010 drama starring Stephen Dorff as a movie star named Johnny Marco, who finds himself promoting a film in Los Angeles and half-heartedly reconnecting with his tween daughter Cleo, played by Elle Fanning. I really like Somewhere. It's a small film in that very little happens, but as with most of Coppola's films, there's so much going on underneath the surface. It's delicate, and it's minimalist, and it's right in her wheelhouse. The whole film exists to make us understand who these people are and what it is they're trying to be to one another. Even if, you know, all they're doing is watching TV together. This is someone else's movie.
You know, I figured whatever I picked would be something that we would be talking about in detail, and I also knew I wouldn't have time to rewatch anything, so I wanted to pick something that I knew well enough that I didn't really need to watch it again in order to have a serious conversation about it as a film or about its imagery or about its meaning. And it's just a movie I'm very fond of, and I never really had an opportunity to talk about it or write about it in any way or do anything with it. And yeah, I feel like it's kind of underappreciated, and a lot of people are very dismissive of my love of it, and regard it as a fairly minor film, but I really love it, so it just seemed like a good film to pick to discuss.
I'm really glad you did. It's one of those films that's, it's got a weird place for me because my own history with Stephen Dorff is that I interviewed him for The Power of One way back when. He was coming up. It was his first major studio picture, I think. He would have been 14 or 15 when he started working on it, and I was maybe 21 or 22, and it was sort of the start of the careers. And then 20 years later we got back to talk again for Somewhere, and the movie casts him as Johnny Marco, a superstar basically, and it's almost this route that he never took, which is really fascinating because he's always been a character actor, and the film casts him as a sort of dissolute movie star, which is a really interesting starting point. You have someone who's never really been identified that way in the public eye, and it makes it kind of a instantly hyper-real, unrealistic thing all at once. And Dorff, he's such a good choice for that part, and I wouldn't have called that. The casting alone just puts it on a different footing right away. He and Elle Fanning are both just so perfectly sympathetic towards each other in these weird, heightened lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think, to me, the most exciting kind of thing is when the director ends up making a decision that, on paper, when you first hear about it, seems very out of left field. Somewhere being made after Marie Antoinette, which is a huge ensemble movie with a very, very impressive cast. And then it's announced that, she's making this film starring Stephen Dorff, who at the time hasn't been in a film that was taken seriously or given any sort of substantial release in quite a while. And I believe sort of probably it really hasn't been in one since. I mean, he seems to work a lot, and a lot of direct-to-video stuff or independent movies that don't really go anywhere. So yeah, right away, it seemed like a really interesting decision. And, you watch the movie and the performance, and you spend a lot of time, or at least I did the first time I watched it, trying to parse, exactly what kind of a guy he's supposed to be and how famous he is and what exactly his place is in the world. The one movie he's promoting gives something of a clue, but, when I saw it, I kind of settled on, in my mind, he was a Kiefer Sutherland type.
Okay.
I don't know why I arrived at that, but just kind of this guy who everybody knew and was in some iconic films and, has a recognizable face, but at this point is, you know, in this period where, like, the fresh young man glory has faded and now he's kind of in this other period. I don't know if that's, you know, that was just my, you know, because I was so consumed with trying to figure out just how famous and successful this guy is supposed to be, because yeah. he seems to have, you know, a lot of the trappings of success, but other than a brief promotion of one film, you don't ever really see any sense of what he's doing. So, and, you know, and that seems to be a fairly big deal, the movie that they're promoting with the junket in the film. So, yeah, it's just an interesting thing. And, yeah, I mean, like, I don't know if I've seen him in a movie since then. I'm sure if I looked it up, he would be in something I've seen in a bit part. But, you know, I mean, that's his movie. And, you know, when a guy like that would get a call from such a well-known filmmaker to, you know, come and be the lead and the follow-up to Marie Antoinette, you know, it's obviously like a, there's an interesting idea there. It's obviously not going down the list of choices and settling on something that you can get. She's in a position where she could get anybody for anything. And he was, you know, I'm sure definitely the first choice. And just the idea of the movie kind of was probably about him and about looking at him. And I found that really interesting and really exciting. And it's neat to kind of, not to say that it's like a, you know, sort of Tarantino, like, second chance, where, like, you find somebody that was famous and bring them back, but it does sort of have a little bit of that identification involved with it. And, yeah, I find, like, his casting in the film to be really interesting. It's a really great performance, and I wondered when watching it if, you know, this was going to usher in a new phase of you know, the Stephen Dorff
career. Yeah, it should have. Like, I feel like it should have. I feel like that the sense I got is that she either knows him really, really well or had grown up knowing him from film and just wanted to unlock something that she's always seen in him.
Yeah, who knows? But it's just very interesting. And, you know, maybe it's just the case where he is actually a really precise and idiosyncratic performer, but he just has to be in the right hands. And, you know, when he was a young man, those hands would be, you know, an 80s kind of... You know, even thinking about it, I can't really think of movies that he's in.
Yeah.
Blade.
Power One, Blade. Those are the really big ones that used him a lot.
And yeah.
And Backbeat, of course.
Right.
And SFW, which no one remembers.
And a movie called Deuces Wild, I remember he was in shortly after Blade.
I saw that.
Like 50s, like, greaser, West Side Story type thing. Yeah, I mean, he's just an interesting guy because he's always around and people kind of know who he is, but... Whatever the you know, collaboration was between the two of them and between him and the written material, I think created a really unique performance that, if nothing else, proves that there's a lot to this performer that people haven't really taken advantage of.
Yeah, I was really quite impressed when I talked to him in, I guess, 2009 when the film came out. We discussed his prep and the way he worked to build a relationship with Elle Fanning. He would pick her up from school and they would drive somewhere. Wherever she had to go, he would pick her up for 2 weeks. And that was just his building a relationship with her, figuring out how to talk to her, figuring out when not to talk to her, just sort of learning their own rhythms before they ever even started rehearsing, which I found really interesting because that's like a trust game between Fanning and Coppola and Dorff, that all of this is going to pay off.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, who knows what the process needs to be for something like that, but I do love their relationship in the film, and it's actually kind of surprisingly sensitive and fully rendered, you know, even though a handful of the scenes, they're not together. Yeah, I mean, she was in... Fanning's great in the movie, too. I don't really know her from much else. I mean, she's around, and now I've seen her in things like, you know, Maleficent, but at the time, you know, she was just still kind of like a child actress, and that film is a very mature and very sophisticated performance that, you know, I think since then she's done a lot of larger things that people really are excited about. So, yeah, I mean, that may have been the first thing I saw her in. I don't know what she was in before that I would have seen, unless she was just like, you know, the precocious child for two or three scenes in something.
Yeah, I think she had a small role in some film that I definitely saw. And then there was this in Super 8 back-to-back, where it's just like this incredible demonstration of range in an almost invisible way.
Yeah, that's true. Super 8's... Yeah, I guess those were around the same time.
Yeah, I think that was the following year. So mood is so important in this film, I think almost more than anything else that Sofia Coppola has made. It is all dependent on, like, there's almost a sense of the room tone and an awareness of where we are. And, you know, the Chateau Marmont stuff is all lifer stuff. She's been there, she's felt that, and, like, the movie knows what it's like to be in an elevator with Benicio del Toro. But it's who Johnny is after all the fame stuff that's where it gets most interesting to me. It's the these, I mean, I think I wrote this at the time, is the sort of grudging relationship that's formed between a father and daughter because there's nothing good on TV and he just ends up interested in her. But that drifting aspect of it is something I've noticed in actors where their attention will become fixed on something for, you know, very, very intensely for a not a brief period of time, but people who perform are attracted to fascinations. And here it just seemed to me to be really kind of beautiful that the fascination is his own child, that he's finally understanding. We get that scene where he just watches her skate and there's nothing to it but the motion and this grace that we get to experience through Johnny's eyes. And that kind of moment can fall really flat a lot of the time. I've seen films reach for something that emotional and just miss, either because the music is wrong or because the cutting is too fast. And the whole of Somewhere just feels like this sort of calm blanket of empathy that expands over us while we watch the character and figure out who he is and what he wants. I mean, is that how you received it when you first saw it? Or
I guess so. I mean, I feel like what you're describing is very close to how most people would describe Lost in Translation, and I would as well. That's clearly what everything you just said is. I feel true about both films. You know, the location and the kind of leisurely pace with which it approaches these kind of moments where people just kind of absorb things. And you know, I liked that film just fine. I didn't like it as much as Virgin Suicides. So I wasn't as high on it as most people, but then Somewhere took all that stuff that I think has been a part of her work, you know, all along, and certainly the kind of atmospheric location that you're talking about is true of the Versailles in Marie Antoinette as well.
Sure.
So, you know, I feel like that kind of specificity is very, you know, much a part of her work no matter what. And, you know, just for me, I was watching the film and really all these little moments became pretty major to me. You know, just everything about it. You know, you're describing the ice skating, which to me felt like, you know, early Sofia Coppola, like, music video type stuff. Just that I feel like there's, I can't remember if she's in it or if she co-directed or what, but there's some music video that she's involved with somehow as like a gymnastics thing for the Chemical Brothers, maybe.
Rings a bell. I can look that up.
Yeah, I don't remember if she's the performer in it or if she was involved with the creation of it. But anyway, like, you know, that sort of, you know, moment, it feels very familiar to her work. And yeah, the whole thing of just the aimlessness and all that, you know, struggling for a connection, Lost in Translation, you know, the point of it is that it's a stranger. And that film deals similarly with, you know, the kind of trappings of public life and being on the other side of fame in the same way that Somewhere does. I just kind of consider, when I saw Somewhere, I felt like, you know, it was the final draft of Lost in Translation. Like, it had taken a lot of that stuff that, again, I liked just fine in the earlier film, but wasn't really, you know, moved to revisit over and over again or really make it one of my favorite films. And then when I saw it in Somewhere, I felt like it was, you know, the end point of a progression that she'd been working towards for a while. And I felt like, you know, as a fan of all the films, this was like the summation and grandest statement on this style and this tone and these types of characters. And then, you know, the next film, Bling Ring, was radically different. It really was like a total, you know, it was no longer about these people struggling to connect in these places. It was like this tightly knit unit of friends, which, you know, there's no tightly knit unit of friends in Lost in Translation, Marie Antoinette, or Somewhere. So, yeah.
Or even the Virgin Suicides. I mean,
well, that feels like a unit to me.
Never really. Well, yeah, but we never really understand the sister. I mean, that's the whole point, right? You have to be held at a slight remove.
Yeah, but
so we don't get to see how they function.
Sure, but
I see your point.
Yeah, it just felt like a really great like summation of the all the films that she made up until that point. And really, to me, the best by far, and one of my favorite films, and one that I revisit often and saw again a few years ago on 35, which was a really nice way to revisit it. It played as part of a Harris Savides tribute after he died, and I think that, you know, his work in the film is very natural and atmospheric feeling in a way that is deceptively simple. It feels just like you show up and capture what is there, but of course there's a great elegance to his work always, and this film specifically. And you know, just even the static opening shot, and then of course the slow zoom by the pool that's in the trailer and on the poster. You know, I mean, moments like that, if to me, if they don't work for someone, they just feel tedious and humiliating. And that, all that stuff, those moments just blow my mind in the film. And that sequence with the zoom, you know, with the stroke song, I think it is, it's just really beautiful. And it gets, you know, I could see how people wouldn't connect to it as much as I have, because it either works or it doesn't. But to me, it just hit every beat of, you know, emotional longing and questions about success and the way it affects people, and the detachment that grows between people who should be close. It hit everything that I love the most in all kinds of movies, and it kind of brought them all together in a really small and simple story that, for me, just was a very comprehensive, you know, just everything. It was just comprehensive of everything she'd worked towards, comprehensive of everything I liked, comprehensive of the work of these actors up until that point. And to me, yeah, just a great film.
Yeah, I was sort of stunned by the reception that it got, and Marie Antoinette had some of the same sort of backlash, I suppose is the right word, but after Lost in Translation, people seemed to turn on her approach very quickly, which never really struck me as sensible. She hasn't deviated. I mean, I think she's made the movie she wants to make, and she has a very recognizable style, the sort of drifting emotional intuition kind of thing going on. And with a friend of mine who sadly didn't live to see Somewhere, said that all of her movies, and he didn't mean this in a bad way, but he said all of her movies basically come down to, I have everything and I'm not happy and I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
And Somewhere also hits that. And even The Bling Ring could sort of fit into that slot if you stretch a bit. But to me, it always seemed to be about excavating that and understanding why people can be unhappy in situations where they should be happy. Lost in Translation falls a little bit short, I think, for me, because it tries to, because Bill Murray is counted on to do more filling in of that character maybe than the script would. With Somewhere, we actually have Dorf working with specific parameters that explain who that guy is a little bit better than I think Murray's character was explained and defined in Lost in Translation.
Sure, but also, I mean, I'm sure people just like Bill Murray more than they like Stephen Dorff.
Yeah, that's probably true.
And are more apt to embrace a film kind of playing with his persona than playing with the Stephen Dorff persona, which, you know, to me is obvious, and that's why the reaction is so radically different. But, you know, I mean, what you're describing is something that I'm interested in for any, you know, filmmaker. And there's, of course, innumerable examples of it, which is, you know, you take the breakthrough film wherever it rests in the filmography. You know, Virgin Suicide is a very promising debut, but Lost in Translation, Academy Award winner, right. You know, she won for Best Screenplay, and Bill Murray was, of course, nominated. The film was nominated for Best Picture. You know, so, you know, where do you go from there? From that plateau of success, there's really nowhere to go. You can't make a movie that does all of that stuff again. So you're sort of handicapped by that success. So, yeah, if you were to look at it that way, you would say that she now finds herself in a position similar to the characters in these films, which is, you know, held back by what you've gotten for yourself in one way or another. So, you know, Marie Antoinette, which again, a film I really liked, revisited it a few years ago and really found it to be better than I even remembered, and I remembered liking it. You know, it's to me a great kind of example in filmmaking where it's like she had knocked it out of the park in the business sense with Lost in Translation, and then got carte blanche and goes and makes this, you know, probably $40 or $50 million period piece on location. You know, that's like a real grand statement, and to me a very admirable kind of thing to do. And of course, basically the only thing you can do in that position is fall flat on your face in the eyes of the public and the industry. You know, unless you're just one of the few where you don't fall flat on your face. But, you know,
that doesn't happen nearly as often.
It doesn't happen very often. And of course, you know, over time, a lot of those films, people come back around to. I mean, Jackie Brown was perceived as a tremendous disappointment, and huge step backwards from Pulp Fiction, and now everybody basically acknowledges that it's the best movie, you know, he's ever made, and just if they don't think it's the best, they regard it as a wonderful film.
Yeah, now everyone's turned on Death Proof, we can go back and see the other stuff.
Yeah, so, and then, you know, everything post Pulp Fiction, I think, until, you know, a later point in your career, he's another example where you're always working to get back to that. And both Somewhere and Bling Ring had fairly mild responses and were not huge hits in the same way that Lost in Translation was, although I think Bling Ring was probably the most successful.
Yeah, I think it did okay internationally.
Of the three, but maybe not. But in any case, you know, it's just an interesting thing. I love the films that filmmakers who I admire make when they're in a position to basically do whatever they want. So Marie Antoinette goes for that. And, you know, I'm sure many people would have seen this period piece with this great ensemble coming and said, you know, here's another awards slam dunk, another huge crossover art house hit. And, you know, the film just is its own thing, and it really didn't go for any of that. And people were disappointed. And then to come back with this, like, tiny movie about a father and daughter set in this luxury hotel in Hollywood, you know, it's as far away from that as possible. But I think perhaps if she followed Lost in Translation up directly with Somewhere, the response to it would have been very different. Perhaps people would have felt it was too repetitive thematically, you know, moving from a hotel in Japan to a hotel in America. But I think that there's an interesting, you know, way to look at the response to Sophia's films, or, you know, anyone's films, just in relation to whatever's come before them.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, as a critic, the auteurist impulse is always going to be there, and you sort of, I find that I'm inclined, well, inclined is the wrong word, but I find myself often trying to frame a film as part of a continuum, just so the audience can understand where the film is coming from, so because they haven't seen it and I'm trying to describe it to them. So with someone like Coppola, when the points of interest are so clear, it's really easy to say, oh, well, this is like this, but only with this guy. But yeah, that does a terrible disservice to what Somewhere is, because it really, I agree with you, I think it's a better film than Lost in Translation. I also think it's almost impossible to convince anybody else of that, because, well, Bill Murray isn't it, and I don't know who this guy is. There was a weird resistance, not just from critics, but from people. I've had a hell of a time getting people to see it since it came out on disc. I mean, how would you, have you evangelized it to people? Have you presented it? And how do you,
yeah, I mean, well, people, I mean, you know, everyone I know in the small world that I live in, you know, saw it when it came out.
Sure.
Or, you know, no, very few people embraced it in the way that I did, or would see eye to eye with me when I was describing what I really liked about it. You know, what you said earlier was exactly what one of my, you know, closer friends said. He said, well, I don't understand why I'm supposed to feel anything for this guy. He's, like, surrounded by beautiful women the entire movie, and he's miserable. And yeah, this is someone, and my response, this is someone who, that describes his own life as well. And I said, he just didn't seem to understand the identification between himself and this character.
Wow.
You know, a miserable guy who everybody loves and whatever. So, you know, it just, to me, felt very real. But you just can't, you said, you know, as a critic trying to shape the, you know, conversation on things, you just can't do that. I mean, the film premiered at Venice, where it won the top prize, so already you have reason to think this must be good.
Right.
I mean, it's not a disaster. We're not talking about a train wreck here, you know. But then, yeah, it's just the critical response to something can only shape it so much, because there's the press and the public response to something, and, you know, the conversation surrounding the release of a film is just entirely dominated by whatever the sexiest way to talk about it is for, you know, the imbecilic marketing people.
Right.
And
the five people Stephen Dorff ogles in Somewhere, click here.
Yeah. So, you know, it's really easy to frame the conversation around a movie like Lost in Translation. You know,
yeah, that's true.
Hey, here's this actor we've all loved for two decades as we've never seen him before. A really, you know, a new way of looking at this guy who's a legend. And also, like, the performance is solidifying this young, talented actress who's been very promising for a long time. Now this is the movie where, you know, we have this actress who we've liked for the last few years, and now she has arrived. So yeah, it's a very easy way to frame that movie and make it sound very appealing. And then, you know, Marie Antoinette, same, you can frame it however you want, but, you know, the word on that movie was, like, this is a huge, ambitious, anachronistic period piece that's, you know, very non-traditional and exactly the sort of thing you would feel like this director would make after her previous film. And, you know, people were kind of ready for that. But then, yeah, it's like, you know, it's just, it's marketing, and it's, you know, the viability of the performers. But saying to people, hey, here's this sensitive, you know, beautiful, nuanced side of Bill Murray is very exciting. Saying, here's this sensitive, nuanced side of Stephen Dorff, people say, who cares?
Yeah. Like,
I mean, even I love him in this film, and I'm saying, you know, I consider myself a fan of his, mostly because of this. I can barely think of other films he's in, but you know.
Yeah, and certainly nothing recent. I mean, like, that's the thing. I think about Burt Reynolds after Boogie Nights, who just did nothing mm-hmm. to capitalize on that resurgence, where, you know, he really could have Tarantino the crap out of that. He could have just never stopped.
He was in, like, an old man heist movie.
Yeah.
Like, right after that, where it was, like, a crew of old men. I think it was called The Crew.
I think you're right.
Like, where Burt Reynolds and a bunch of old guys rob a bank or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, that's kind of what happens to a lot of actors like that. I mean, you look at, you know, the Tarantino actors.
Travolta's a good example.
I mean, he had it for, like, 4 years after Pulp Fiction, but then it, you know, disappeared in a different way. And then Robert Forster and Pam Grier, you know, after Jackie Brown, they have this moment where they're very viable. And then after a while, they're just kind of in... You know, they work all the time because actors like this obviously really like performing. And,
sure,
you know, Michael Madsen, of course, like when you see him in a Tarantino movie now, it's so exciting. It's so harmonious. And then you look up what he's done since the last Tarantino movie, and he's in like 12 movies a year that I've never even heard of.
Oh, yeah.
But then he can still be the lead in, you know, a movie that'll be one of the biggest things of the year whenever Tarantino wants him. So, you know, some actors just have that kind of a dynamic. And getting past, you know, the kind of puerile response that somewhere is the Stephen Dorff movie, which most people would want to just write it off as.
Yeah.
You know, even though you have no reason to discount this performer, it's not like he's someone who's been, like, you know, abjectly terrible in films and now we're supposed to take him seriously. You know, it's not, he's not like a joke. He's just a different kind of performer. So yeah, I never really knew how to sell it to people, but, you know, I don't really get too hung up on that. Clearly people are going to respond to it. I have always kind of searched for other people who, you know, consider it to be like a perfect film and one of the, you know, for me, it'll, you know, tops of the decade, ultimately, for sure. It was 2010, so it'll be tops of the decade.
Yeah, okay. So we, I guess I would have spoken to Dorff in December just before it opened.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it didn't play the Toronto Film Festival, but he came through on a press tour for it just before it opened.
Okay.
So it must have been just before Christmas.
Yeah, I remember it opening in fall because it played at Venice.
Yeah, and it played in New York too, didn't it?
No.
No?
I don't think it played the New York Film Festival.
Why wouldn't they?
That's a good question, actually.
Because I know it didn't play TIFF, so I just assumed it went to New York.
I feel like if it did, I must not have seen it there because I just saw it when it was released. That's a great question, actually. I don't know. Well, I think even just not knowing is somewhat relevant. You know, the fact that it's kind of, you know, it just doesn't have this clear reputation and it doesn't really have this sense of its own success narrative in the culture and in the film culture, which I find, you know, I find unfortunate because to me it really is a great film and I think it was viewed as kind of a stumble for her and then came back in full force with the, you know, reasonably successful Bling Ring, which a film I liked, you know, for what it was. I mean, I had absolutely no problems with it. It delivered exactly what I was excited about for and what I hoped it would be. But I found it to be much less emotionally satisfying and much less, you know, have much fewer opportunities for introspection and for me to have this kind of sad feeling while watching it that, you know, her films had up until that point. So it was a very fun movie by design.
But it doesn't invite you in the same way that...
No, but it has this kind of interesting hollowness that is one of my favorite elements of Somewhere. You know, this kind of Los Angeles culture of, you know, the rot, just the soul rot and culture rot that Somewhere kind of exists in tandem with and Bling Ring really revels in, which is something that is a, you know, lifelong East Coast resident, you know, that lived here for, you know, almost 12 years now. I find that kind of soulless California moral decay very fascinating. And I think that, you know, she grew up there and understands that. And these films really present to me a very complete and sensitive depiction of something that I'm very fascinated by from the outside. So that was my favorite part of The Bling Ring, is that I did see it as a continuation of that, you know, side of Somewhere, which I found very emotional. But that, to me, was the only real emotional point of The Bling Ring. The rest of it was just kind of fun.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because, you know, you wondered when watching that movie, you know, these kind of fame-obsessed children, you know, would they be excited by Johnny Marco? Like, would they have a context for him? But they would be excited, you know, by the allure of the chateau And they'd be excited by the, you know, sense of celebrity surrounding him, even if he personally meant nothing to them.
Yeah.
The way I would imagine, you know, kids today who are, you know, into celebrities might not know who a Kiefer Sutherland is or a Stephen Dorff. But to me, like, if I saw one of those guys at a bar, I'd be pretty excited.
Sure, yeah.
But, you know, the characters in The Bling Ring, you don't really know what their relationship is with actual celebrity show business. It's just kind of their relationship to, like, current fleeting celebrity.
Yeah, they know who's on TMZ. They know what they've done.
So, you know, the Johnny Marco character is kind of interesting, as we were talking about earlier, because he exists a little bit outside of that. And it's very nebulous just exactly how famous he is, but mm-hmm. obviously has money and, you know, he hasn't lost his money. He's not like a guy who was famous and hasn't done anything for a while. He's, right. you know, consistently wealthy, or at least he is when we find him in the movie.
Yeah, and in demand.
Yeah.
Because people are still courting him.
Yeah. Well, I'd imagine that you could be pretty unsuccessful and still be courted by somebody.
Yeah.
At least, you know, as a aging Hollywood male actor.
Right.
You know?
It depends on where the money's coming from, but yeah. there'll always be. Yeah. I suppose like Eastern Europe will always want Johnny Marco.
Yeah. A guy in his like mid to late 40s who was really successful when he's in his 20s will always have something to do if he wants to, but he's not going to have Lamborghinis or whatever car he drives.
Right.
I think it's a Lamborghini, might be a Porsche or something.
But probably all of them.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've seen the car in the first scene and then at the end of the movie again. But, you know, that kind of Hollywood side of things is something that I'm always very mystified by, and my desire to live within it is zero, but my desire to kind of vacation in it when I'm watching a film like Somewhere is very high. I find it very interesting to see what these struggles are, and oftentimes I don't have a hard time believing them as realistic or very likely to be quite relatable, and that the film really showed me a lot of that in a really non-spectacular, very minimal way, which most of those things don't. Most of those things, like an Entourage, for example, focus on the excess of that. But to me, I think there's an equal amount of truth in both versions of depicting that lifestyle. And most things go big to parody the excess and show the kind of, you know, various failings and traps that come with that kind of success. But Somewhere just kind of observes it in a very, very admirably objective way.
Yeah.
Which is a quality in filmmaking that I'm attracted to no matter what. But I think the film's objectivity towards him and towards his lifestyle is very uncommon for that kind of showbiz narrative.
Yeah. Well, I think the showbiz, for the most part, stuff like Entourage, I think is... I don't believe it's conscious, but I think it's unconsciously designed as gatekeeper stuff. It's like, look how awesome this is, but you wouldn't really be happy. Don't do this. Like, it's all like Sex and the City. Don't come to New York. Don't be part of this culture. We really don't have the room for you. So we're going to show you just how great and bad it is at the same time at a heightened way that's supposed to terrify you into staying in wherever you actually live. There's this thesis, I think Patton Oswalt started it, but it's a brilliant idea, that CSI, NCIS, all the CBS murder shows are designed to terrify you into staying home mm-hmm. because there are murderers everywhere. Next door, down the street, at your child's school, murderer, 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 and they're the most grotesque and horrible things. I felt like Entourage plays into that as well. It's this weird kind of aspirational fantasy that the whole show keeps telling you don't deserve this. You will never get this the way that Vinny has it. So don't even try.
Mm-hmm.
And Somewhere, by making him a person, by making him a lonely, disconnected parent, I kind of get what that might be like. I don't want that life, and I don't aspire to Johnny Marco's career, but I see why he'd be unhappy. Like, I get that. It's none of the... I don't immediately go, oh, come on, you're an idiot. You should be happy. I understand that mm-hmm. he's looking for something, and the movie shows us the process of finding a something.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, you could... if one were so inclined to discuss something like Entourage and Somewhere in relationship to one another as a 15 years later kind of thing.
Sure, yeah.
He has this one buddy who he hangs out with a lot in the movie, comes over, he plays video games, hangs out with his kid. Like, you know, that's like Entourage friend kind of behavior that mm-hmm. Johnny still seems to have, you know, with his friend Chris Pontius from Jackass.
Yeah, which is also really interesting casting because I would not have seen that guy as having depths.
Yeah.
To plumb, and there they are.
Yeah. No, they had great dynamic and great chemistry, but, you know, it's as you were saying, it's very easy to look at Somewhere and say, why would this guy be miserable? And it's harder to look at Entourage and say anything relating to that because Entourage is very subjective. It subjects you so that you are having the fun ride with these guys. You're in the passenger seat with the blasting music, you know, beautiful women everywhere, and you're right there along for the ride with them. And at no point does the film step away long enough and say to the audience, for this passage, we as the filmmakers have no opinion on the proceedings.
Right.
Fill in the gaps for yourself. It's always, you know, you're along for the ride. Isn't this fun? Which is great if you want subjective entertainment, which I often do and most people often do, and the entire entertainment industry is predicated upon the
sure.
existence of subjective entertainment. But then, you know, taking a film that presents this counterpoint to that, and, you know, the filmmaking in somewhere is very subjective. It's very, as we've already talked about, it's very isolating and very calm and very adrift. You mentioned, you know, room tone earlier. All those tricks of making this world feel empty and hollow is a really subjective trick to get you to identify with him. And then once you're there, then it's all objective. The actual emotions of the film are very, you know, the film is not judgmental
yeah.
of him or his lifestyle or his relationship with his daughter or his friends. It presents it simply as it is, but puts it into a aesthetic framework of emptiness and shallowness and hollow, you know, nothingness. And that, you know, to me is the kind of perfect balance for a film to be in its craft, identifying you with a certain way of feeling that the characters are also living with, but then with its story and its narrative and its emotional moments, really leave it up to you. And that's my favorite kind of filmmaking. And the more you think about that dichotomy, the more you realize the true, you know, genius of excellent filmmaking. And to me, the worst kind of film would be one that the visuals of it, the actual making of it, is totally objective. There's nothing there. There's nothing particular. It might as well just be, you know, a three-camera sitcom.
Right.
Kind of style where it's just master shot, close up, you know, just no pulse in the cinema of it to push you into feeling anything. And then all of that just comes from the beats and the story, where, you know, this is the moment where the music swells and you feel this way, this is the moment where you dislike this character, this is the moment where you come back around to liking them. That's, you know, the worst kind of movie to me. It can, there's a world in between these two, but to me, the film that, you know, uses all of the tools of cinema, the camera and the music and the placement of the actors in the room and the way that the sets look, to make you see what they're seeing and feel what they're feeling, but then uses the entire actual content of the script to break that down and just kind of present things, is, you know, just very exciting to me. And she does that really well, always. I mean, you know, Bling Ring also is fairly non-judgmental, considering this, depicting criminal activity.
Well, even that single take that plays out almost like a specimen box, where you're just distanced from...
Oh, the zoom on that house,
yeah. Not only distanced from the characters, but from the crime. You're just observing, literally observing, as this happens, and we get a little closer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a great example of what I'm talking about, because you're not in there with them at that moment. You don't see them having fun. Mm-hmm. You do at other points in the film. But, you know, by giving you one sequence like that, the message is pretty clear that make of this what you will.
Yeah.
When you're in there and you're in the party, in the entourage sense, and you're watching the corks get popped, and you're seeing, you know, all the fun and the high fives, then you can't make of this what you will. Yeah. But, yeah, you know, she really leaves that open to the viewer. Of course, you know, Lost in Translation is very mythically make of this what you will kind of movie, obviously, with its mm-hmm. with its final moments. And, you know, Marie Antoinette, again, similar to Bling Ring, and somewhere depicts this kind of sickening excess that would be very easy to just say, hey, we're just kind of making fun of people who have this kind of excess and treat it so poorly. But instead, it just kind of lets you sit with it and hang out. And by the end, either you've arrived at a very personal and emotional conclusion, as I have done, or you're just kind of saying, you know, like, what am I supposed to get? Why am I supposed to feel for this guy? He seems to have it all. This seems like a great lifestyle. You know, which is only a problem when you make a movie about people with a great lifestyle. You know, people in the Bling Ring don't really have a great lifestyle. I mean, they're rich children who have nice homes, but, you know, their lifestyle is fairly non-existent. But, you know...
Yeah, they don't really appreciate or even seem to understand how they live.
Yeah, they haven't gotten to the point yet where they can process what a lifestyle is, except lifestyles of the rich and famous.
Right, which is what they want. Even yeah. They already kind of have one.
Yeah, so it's very interesting to watch her kind of, you know, play variations on this theme, to me, with very different results across different films that are, as with, you know, all great bodies of work, staggeringly consistent and endlessly fun to kind of navigate and find the connections. You know, this isn't a filmmaker who we get something from every year. You know, enough time passes in between the films that you're kind of ready to revisit them when the other one, when a new one comes out. I guess I must have seen somewhere at the Harris Savides tribute retrospective in 2013 as well, if I remember correctly. Yeah, like June of 2013 was when I last saw it. So right around that time.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I guess Bling Ring just came out a few weeks after that. So, you know, it's just, to me, a very rich body of work that is, you know, since Lost in Translation, as this kind of totemic, Oscar-nominated, independent, you know, movie. One that, a career that seems to defy people's expectations in a way that leads them to feel betrayed by whatever promise they felt Lost in Translation showed.
Yeah, which is really more about them investing the wrong elements of themselves in expectation, because, again, you know, she's been consistent. She's made the movies she always said she was. So she's always sort of indicated in this direction.
Yeah, and the work to me is just getting better. I mean, definitely developing. And it's just weird to me that when Somewhere came out, people were so dismissive of it. And I saw it two or maybe even three times in the theater in its initial release. And I was telling, you know, as you asked earlier, I wasn't really convincing people that it was what I saw it as. I was just like, you got to see this movie. Like, don't not go see this movie. It's like, and people were like, really? Like, I heard it wasn't so... I was like, no, you have to go see it. Like, and then everyone would kind of tell me, like, I don't really know what you saw in that movie. But you know, then you find people that are into it. But yeah, that's just kind of my... I mean, it's not like my cause. It's not like I'm always trying to convert people to it. I just love it, and I think about it a lot as this kind of Hollywood narrative becomes more and more prominent in my life.
Sure.
And I've, you know... Two times I've been to the Chateau, I've certainly gotten, you know, a sense of titillation and joy from recognizing various areas that they shot in, which, you know, it's just like, you know, the Hollywood tour bus type stuff to be like, oh, they shot that scene over there. But still, it's fun for me, and it really does feel like a mythical place. I'd never been there when I saw the film, so it feels like a mythical place. But the more interested I get in the way that these Hollywood narratives kind of play out, you know, both for directors and in the sense of the world, the deeper and richer this film becomes to me. And I just find myself thinking about it a lot.
Well, it's great. And I think that the wrap question becomes obvious now, which is how or if the film has influenced your own work. I mean, have you lifted any attitude, movement, consideration? Is there anything from Somewhere that you've pulled into your own work as a totem? I was going to say that when we spoke about Listen Up, Philip, the end of that film is similarly, it's ambiguous, although it's pretty clear which direction Philip is going to go in. For me, the ending of Somewhere is ambiguous, but it's hopeful, because I get the sense throughout this film that she loves him and she wants him to be okay. And by she, I mean Coppola. Mm-hmm. The film wants Johnny to make it work with his daughter and to find a route that lets him be a person instead of a movie star. And with Philip, you said what you had said, and I think what the movie strongly implies, is that he will not learn, but he will succeed. Like, he'll be a better author for his absolute lack of human interaction and compassion. So it doesn't feel like the two are related, but I was just wondering if there's any sort of echo going on.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly, I don't know how much I would have thought about this, although, as I just said, I did see Somewhere for either my third or fourth time in the theater 2 months before we shot Philip, so I'm sure it had some effect. You know, the final moment and image of the two films is staggeringly similar, now that you mention it, albeit with different underlying meaning, but
sure,
the
sure.
actual physical movement of the last moment and the treatment of this main male character in the final moments of the films is actually fairly similar. For whatever reason, I don't know, maybe at some point I thought that was an intentional thing, but over time I've never analyzed it as such. But, you know, I mean, to me, the influence is just what you said, which is, you know, your dismissive friend saying, why is this person unhappy? They're successful and they have people surrounding them. How could anyone be unhappy with that? I mean, that's my thesis. You know, that's my favorite question to ask about a character who's struggling with feeling something other than completely elated at all times. But the character is a lot more interesting to me if they have a lot of stuff that most people would think is what you need to be happy. You know, it's a lot easier to say, oh, this character seems miserable if it's a single mother in a trailer park raising six children and working three jobs. I don't have any questions about why that person is miserable.
Sure.
But, you know, you have a character like Philip or Johnny Mirko, and to me the hows and whys of what goes on inside this guy's head is enough for a movie, and it's something I find very, you know, rich and interesting. You know, stylistically, there's really nothing you can do inspired by that film unless you have... I mean, you know, as I was saying earlier, the Savides look of that and the other films he shot, you know, around the same time, Margot at the Wedding, you know, have this very minimal naturalism about them, but it's actually very expensive and complicated.
Yeah.
And, you know, making movies at the level I've been, you don't really have the option to... I mean, you can be as inspired by it as you want, but you need a lot of technical stuff to pull that off. It's not just a 16mm camera with no lights, which is usually about what I'm operating with.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, just even the durational emphasis that some parts of these films have, you know, I mentioned the zoom by the pool, which again is, you know, a moment that they put on the poster, but still a very powerful, interesting moment. You know, one of the only shots in Philip that's not handheld is like a 50-second zoom similar to that shot starting in and coming out, which occurs, you know, about 15 minutes into the film, with Elizabeth Moss's character on a rooftop. I'm not saying we stole the idea of that, but just I like the idea of that, and it's something that if you can commit to it and do it and not in editing get scared and say, oh, let's just cut this in half, but you can really let it be a minute of a zoom. And then of course Queen of Earth is a film full of long slow zooms, but coming from a different set of influences. But again, like, you know, the influence is just that there's a real sense of commitment to every one of the ideas. There's no wishy-washiness, and it says, you know, we're going to start this movie with several minutes of car driving in a loop, and just does it. You know, no point in the process is it, well, okay, this is not the right way to start a movie. Let's start with something a little bit more exciting and come back to this. Let's start with him getting, you know, these two strippers into his room and then have a title card that says 3 weeks earlier.
Right.
And then, you know, there's no, you know, her films don't have that. She's very, the films are just full of confident decisions, and for better or worse, you either just take them for what they are or you don't. I love them, and pretty much every one of them and every one of the films works for me. But the confidence of those decisions and these stylistic choices is an influence for sure, and really just to be able to decide that you're going to do something like that and then do it. And then have people maybe say, I don't know if this is going to really connect with people, and then just be like, well, it connects with me, so that's what I'm going to do. That's what I feel watching her films, and somewhere more so than any of them.
My thanks to Alex Ross Perry, whose latest feature film, Queen of Earth, makes its Canadian premiere on Tuesday, October 13th at the Royal in Toronto as a presentation of MDFF and Refocus. The show starts at 7 p.m., tickets are $8 in advance and $10 at the door. Just search Facebook for either Refocus or MDFF, and you'll find the event page. And if you're in the U.S., Queen of Earth is available for rental right now on iTunes and Amazon Video. You can find Alex on Twitter at Alex Ross Perry, all one word. And if you haven't seen Listen Up Philip, you should find that too. It's available on DVD and for sale or rental on iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play. Somewhere is available on Blu-ray and DVD from Universal Studios Home Entertainment in the U.S. and E1 in Canada. It's also available for rent and purchase on iTunes and Google Play. And it's very good. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, or on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review up on iTunes, that would be splendid. Thanks for listening.